Warning, this episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Guru Sang Podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is Vinny Cheshelski. Since the mid-90s, Vinny has been one of the most in-demand session players in Nashville, having well over 5,000 sessions under his belt. He's played all types of music and toured and recorded with the legends of the past and the giants of the future. But what makes Vinny so special is not his blistering high chops, it's his awesome approach to life and his ability to overcome adversity. So pour yourself a big glass, pull up a chair, and let the hang begin. So welcome to this episode of the Trumpet Guru's Hang. I am with Mr. Vinny Cheshelski. What's up, Vin?
How you doing, Jose? Man, it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too, man. And I appreciate you taking time. I know you're in the middle of a move.
Yes, sir.
But you are a mover and a shaker, so nothing new to you.
Right.
So, Vinny, you are a very, very highly respected player in the Nashville area. You're just a nationally known, internationally known guy because of all the sessions that you've been on and all the recordings you've been a part of, touring and the whole nine yards. But how's the music scene in Nashville?
Man, it's really interesting. You know, I think the live scene, like everywhere else in the country and in the world for a while, has suffered greatly. My last live gig was sometime around the beginning of March, I think. And we had a couple more scheduled. And, you know, of course, when this thing first started happening, the COVID-19 thing, we just didn't know. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't know how Nashville was going to react. And they've been back and forth with the phased in plans. And there for a while, you know, after about 2 months, they opened up Lower Broadway, which is where hundreds of live musicians play on the nightly basis. You know, it's just 7 nights a week. They start music at 12 in the afternoon because of the tourists. That's the big tourist area of town. A lot of guys are employed down there. And, they opened up, the numbers went up, they closed down, they've opened up again. Now they're opening up as of today, which is, the 18th of August, 2020. They're opening up, but they're only allowing 25 people in each bar. So it's like, how do you make money doing that? I mean, everybody would have to have a $200 bar tab, which is not out of question, you know what I'm saying? But on a consistent basis, I don't know, you know, so it's rough. I'm not as affected by that, so I can be compassionate to those guys, but I can also say, both my parents are high risk. They don't live here, but they live in Pennsylvania, and I hope that the people in Pennsylvania are thinking the same way I do, because they don't want to make them sick. So it's kind of a bummer. The session thing has been really interesting. I do a lot of small section stuff. I'm not doing the big orc sessions, which they do here in Nashville. They're doing some video games and they're doing some movie scores. We do mostly records. We do some movie stuff too, but it's always that kind of pop, R&B, rock and roll, jazz, small group stuff. So I have a partner I work with. It's just the two of us most of the time, and we just stack everything up like crazy. Tomorrow we're going in and doing another Christmas record with three horns, and we're stacking a full big band. And really, that's just a budget thing, because I would much rather play with a full band and a rhythm section live. But, you know, when you're talking about union scale, even if it's limited pressing, you know, at $350 a guy per session times 17, or you could do it with three guys, you know, and so the session thing kind of shut down for about a month. But because of our infrastructure, I stay about 15 feet away from my partner, my tenor player. He also engineers, and we feel safe, and we're socially distanced. And I come in and I say, "Hey, Fred, how you doing?" And he says, "Hey, Barney, how's it going?" And we get after it, and then we say goodbye. And I haven't shook his hand in 4 or 5 months. So sessions are kind of hot and cold. You know, 1 week we'll do, like tomorrow we're doing a record, and then Thursday I got another one, and then next week we've got three scheduled so far. But then the week after that, there's nothing on the books right now. So it's really, really super hit or miss, man. Really hit or miss. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing that, you know, when you think about the impact that music has on society, and a lot of people take that for granted, that, you know, the way that the arts have been hit, you know, I really wonder what things are going to look like next year. And
well, people are now, even more so than 6 months ago, people are consuming a lot of music. They really are, because when you're at home and, you know, and you're watching the Talking Heads on the TV screen, there's only so much of that you can take. You know, my wife and I, Beth, hi Beth, we watch the news, but you can only watch it for long enough, for me, long enough to get the information that you need, and then you got to turn it off because it's just so much pounding negativity. And music is an escape for a lot of people. So the demand is there. I think the demand is there. I think we as the music industry have to figure out a safe way to create the music. And what that means is a lot of what we're doing right here, you know, if you have a song or if I have a song and I want a trumpet on it, I send it to you, you pop it on there. I know a lot of guys that are doing full section stuff, one horn at a time. Trumpet player lays down his, sax player lays down his trumpet. And you know, they're still creating some really great music. It just never, to me, it never feels the same as when you're in the studio feeling the vibe of the other people, really enjoying it, getting into it, the excitement, the way the music is kind of a roller coaster ride. But the demand is there. We need to figure out how to create it so that we can keep up with the demand. I think now more than ever, people are willing to spend a little bit of money to comfort themselves. And music definitely does that, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even, yeah, the pivots that businesses have to make, every business has had to make some level of adjustments. Even the ones that, you know, were able to continue on, like my wife works in healthcare. So, you know, she's a nurse, frontline kind of person. But, you know, while they weren't particularly shutting down, they have had to adjust some of their the structure and who goes where and that sort of stuff. So, you've got that side. And then you've got people like, you know, musicians who are relying on public. And, you know, like we see that in the sports world, you know, the Big Ten and Pac-12 just announced that they're going to ditch the season. And I know that's going to make your wife very unhappy.
She is not, she's not happy. She keeps telling me that every Saturday at noon, she's going to replay the Ohio State Alabama game from the first year of the playoffs where they just whipped our butts, and we'll just watch it. It'll be like Groundhog Day every week. Yeah. And that'll make her happy and me sad. You know, the SEC and the ACC have not, they're saying they're going to forge forward, man, but I just cannot figure out what that looks like. It's like, you know, part of what I do is, you and I have talked about this before, Pearl Drums. You know Pearl Drums, the big drum company? Mm-hmm. They're, you know, one of the top drum manufacturers in the world. They also sell a line of front-facing marching instruments from the Adams Company. Mm-hmm. Adams Custom Brass is now making Adams Marching Brass. And there's several big universities, Cincinnati, Georgia Tech, you know, a bunch of Iowa, a bunch of really big universities that are using the instruments. You can't write socially distanced drill for marching band or drum and bugle corps or any of those activities. And so that market is, for right now, it's gone. It's absolutely flat dead in the water. And, you know, the way sports go, is the way the marching band goes. Because if the Big Ten were to do games, they would probably put a 50 or 60 piece socially distanced pep band in the stand somewhere, you know, even though they wouldn't have a big crowd. So it's, man, it's a, I wish I was smarter and I could come up with like a solution, but man, it's a drag.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Now, with your session work, I mean, your resume, your discography, I mean, you've done well over 5,000, probably pushing 6,000 sessions by this point. You're across the board. I mean, people, for the longest time, and I was one of those people, you know, felt like Nashville was only about country music, or then the contemporary gospel scene became very, very big in Nashville. But there's also a lot of pop stuff that's being done down there. So, you know, you've got to be able to be really versatile in terms of your stylistic approach to music. So what, in terms of the way that sessions work in Nashville, what do you see as being like the biggest section or the segment of music that's really calling for the use of horn players like you?
Well, it's really all over the map. I mean, I've said this before when talking about this, when you can, you know, in the same week go in and do a Lynyrd Skynyrd record, and then man, it's so funny. I worked with this girl years ago. Her name is Lynn Marie, Lynn Marie Rink. She had a band called Lynn Marie and the Box Hounds, and she was like this. She was considered a polka band of all things, but it was really kind of this hard ska rock and roll with like a two beat background. It's hysterical, man. And it's, the musicianship was absolutely off the charts, man. One of the records I did with them, we cut live. So she had drums, bass. I think she had a piano player. She played squeeze box, you know, she played accordion, and it was three horns, and sitting like spitting distance from me was Vince Gill playing, picking on the guitar and doing a little singing. So it's like, it's so all over the map. So Skynyrd, and then a polka band, which by the way was nominated 2 or 3 years in a row for a Grammy, which is just often overlooked.
Yeah.
Category of polka. I say, but you know, hey man, a Grammy is a Grammy, right? And then and then later that week work for somebody like Kirk Franklin or Donnie McClurkin or one of the old school, you know, Shirley Caesar or Rance Allen or one of those things. And the musical diversity is pretty incredible. So there's a couple different ways they do charts here. I mean, they do sessions here. One is, you walk in, you're ready to play at 10 o'clock. They throw a chart on the stand, first time you've seen it, first time you've heard the song, and you play it. And you have to play it like you've, and I tell this to musicians all the time, you have to play it like you've been playing it for 20 years and you've been loving it for 20 years. The first time you see it.
Yeah.
It's really an incredible skill set to have, you know. And of course, it's the studio, so, you know, we'll read it down. And then, but a lot of times, man, on those sessions, we would go 60 or 80 bars through a chart on the first read. And that would be what wound up on the record, you know, 60 or 80 bars out of 150 bars. And then somebody would squeak or squawk, mostly this guy right here. And then we would have to stop and kind of go back. But, it you know, it's fascinating. And then the other kind of session is a head chart. So for the charts, you got to be able to read. You got to be able to play with a lot of feeling and a lot of soul, a lot of interpretation often. One of the arrangers that I work with a lot is Lloyd Berry. Lloyd is kind of the godfather of gospel strings and horns. And, you know, I would look at a piece and the lick was, you know, bee boot up, and I would squeeze into it a little bit and go dwee doot up, and he would, 9 times out of 10, he would go, yeah, all right. But that 10th time he would go, Vinny, let's play that one straight. You know, so you're kind of, it's kind of a guessing game based on what you know. Mm-hmm. So that skill of having listened to copious amounts of that kind of music, even though you're kind of on the leading edge of creating what's coming out next, mm-hmm. you got to lean on what you know. So, you know, reading, accuracy, pitch, obviously, the full range of the horn and being able to play in the full range of the horn from playing a high A in one bar and going all the way down to playing that 2D trombone, you know, that kind of thing. Got to be able to get around the horn really well. So the other type is the head charts. The head charts is what we're doing more of these days for us because it's convenient and it's less time consuming. Tyler and I will get an MP3 with the full rhythm section and the vocals, or we get tracks, you know, and we create our own mix. But more often than not, it's the MP3. We load it into Logic and we listen to the song. Sit down at 10 o'clock in the morning, we listen to the whole song. We listen to all the vocals, we listen to where the, you know, where the channels are and the bridge and then the choruses and all that and what the ending is. We go all the way back to the beginning and we start creating the parts on the fly. What we'll do is we'll do 8 bars. We'll do an intro and we'll get a real solid part. And then we'll go in and we'll put a second trumpet part, second tenor part on it. And then sometimes a third trumpet part, a high trumpet part, and then come in and do 2 flugelhorn passes so it gets that real thickness. And then Tyler will throw a baritone saxophone on there. Everything is close mic'd. Everything is also room stereo mic'd. So it's just got that gigantic sound. So again, understanding the genre, understanding what the producer and the artist have asked you to do. A lot of the relationships that we have now, they trust us. So they go, just do your thing. And then some guys will put a little keyboard thing down and they'll say, this is what I want to do, or follow the guitar here going into the chorus or whatever the deal is. And so it's so thrilling every time I get to go into the studio, man. I still drive up in the driveway. I got butterflies in my stomach because I don't know what's coming. And it's absolutely the passion of my life to be able to get in there and be, so you have to have that too.
Yeah.
And I think the most important thing, again, we've talked about this before, but the most important thing is to serve the music properly, no matter what situation you're in. We have played on some incredible tracks. I would say 99% of the tracks that we played on are just amazing, that somebody could pull this out of their soul, communicate it to the players, and record it. And then, of course, we add to the top of it. There is 1% of them that are kind of stinkers. But it's still the most important thing in that artist and producer's life. So being able to go in and really believe that this moment that you're in right now, recording in the studio, is the most important thing that you could be doing that day or any other day. And then you chew on it, you put it down onto tape or onto numbers, and you move on. You know, it's so you have to have that skill too. You have to be able to communicate on a very high level with the producer and the artist, and then take their vision, make it yours, and then put it down on tape. So it's a wide variety of skill sets.
Yeah. And like you said, you never know what's going to be coming your way. So
exactly right. That's exactly right. Could be whole notes, come to Jesus in whole notes. It could also be that when that fly dunked its feet in the inkwell and just ran across the page, you know, wow.
Yeah. Well, that keeps you on your toes, man, for sure. So in terms of your playing, the style that you use, obviously you have to vary your style based on the style of the music that you're doing. But, the people who have influenced you the most in terms of your approach to the trumpet and, you know, arranging concepts, who would those people be?
Jerry Hay, Gary Grant, Chuck Finley, the Sea Wind Bunch, Chicago is a huge influence. So if you could take and morph that super tightness of Jerry with that sometimes trombone lead of Chicago, I love those 2D lines that they do where James Pankow is playing the lead part.
Yeah.
I think that was a matter of practicality when they first started. And as Lee went on, he started to develop his range a little bit more. But I think in the beginning, he was not a, he was not like a high note guy. And so right. James wrote according to that. So they've been a huge influence, Earth, Wind & Fire. It's really the really super tight, really, really nice, crunchy harmonies. But Jerry, for years, man, I mean, you listen to some of his stuff and it sounds like if you played it on a piano, you would have to use all 10 fingers, a couple of toes and your nose up here.
Yeah.
But that guy and that section has made a living on perfectly executed and in tune octaves. If you listen to a lot of the stuff that they play, yeah. Just absolutely amazing. But Jerry, who is an absolute hero of mine, it would be the number one influence on me as a player and an arranger, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think you can be in the field of studio work and especially if you're working in the genre of like pop music, R&B and stuff like that, you can't do that kind of music and not list Jerry as being like, your go-to guy, because he kind of wrote the book on that.
I agree 100%. And now he's eating good food and drinking good wine, and he's still arranging like crazy. And man, it's wonderful to see somebody have such an amazing career and still be able to do it kind of when he wants. You know what I mean? He's like, yeah, I'll take that, or maybe I won't. I think I'm going to France this week.
Yeah, I know. We're talking about about Jerry, and you had Jerry and Gary and Chuck Finley and that session kind of had its core, Bill Reichenbach or Charlie Loper on trombone. So it was a very pretty consistent group, and therefore they got a very consistent sound. They knew how each other were going to play. And you said that you have a partner that you work with right now, but there are other guys that you've kind of worked with more consistently over the years in Nashville. Who are some of the guys that?
Well, Roy Agee is a trombone player. He was in the last iteration of Prince's band with Phil Lasseter. Phil's out in L.A. and is a prolific gospel and pop player and writer. I mean, he's really a gifted arranger. Roy, I've known probably since he was a freshman in college. I think I've known him for 20 years. He's a local product. He's a trombone player extraordinaire, just absolutely amazing. He's currently touring with Lauren Daigle when they tour. She's a contemporary Christian artist. And she loves him so much that when they went to Europe and when they were going to go to Australia, they couldn't take the whole band. They took a trombone player. They took a pop band with a trombone player as a soloist. That's how prolific this guy is. And it goes from everything from really in your face, the most intense thing, fire coming out of the end of the horn, to the most beautiful and incredible ballad that you ever heard in your life. Along those lines, Barry Green, who is a staple here in Nashville and really one of the finest musicians I've ever worked with, trombone player. As far as trumpet goes, if you heard anything from like 1984 through a couple of weeks ago that came out of Nashville, there's a guy named Mike Haynes who played on it. And Mike, again, Tullahoma, local product, one of the best human beings and musicians I've ever come across. Just walked into the magic trumpet closet when he was a kid and came out playing double C's, but playing them in a way that served the music and that was musically relative. And so the other guy would be, and I've done thousands of recordings with Steve Patrick. Steve is a good friend, Patrick Mouthpieces, and a prolific studio guy here in town, and probably the most gifted trumpet player I've ever played with. Technically, just can play anything. He can play really killer lead, double C's, double D's, super, super prolific on the horn. Put that down, next song, play a piccolo trumpet solo that would bring tears to your eye, and then pick up the E flat and play C trumpet, and then go back to just blazing lead trumpet part. I've been really, really lucky. Just a few others. Chris McDonald, prolific arranger. Again, if you saw anything from him, anything from the 80s on, he's probably the arranger on. He's also a great trombone player. Then there's just Tyler Summers and Mark Douthit and Sam Levine and Doug Moffat good golly, Miss Molly's saxophone player. We're so blessed with so many great saxophone players. And every single one of them knows how to play a short note. This is
that
so,
possible?
It is. If you come here to Nashville and you say, and you play a short note, the next time you play that passage, the saxophone player standing next to you will play it short. I would say 95% of the guys. It's uncanny. And then on top of that, all of the guys that I listed are incredible soloists that make you feel something that you didn't feel before you listened to the song. So they have a very keen understanding of what it takes to be transparent in a section. I did a session not years ago with Doug Moffat. And it was a gospel thing, and it was just he and I. And we had a barrier between us, so I couldn't see him. And he was playing alto. He was playing the alto pass. We played. We did about 8 bars, and I stopped. And I kind of leaned forward, and I said, "Doug, are you going to play?" And he said, "I was playing." His sound was so transparent in the section, and so perfectly in tune. You know, alto and trumpet. And that can be a wicked combination as far as pitch and interpretation. He was so transparent, I didn't even know he was playing. It was staggering. The rest of that session, I was smiling so much, I could barely play. It was really, and they're all like that, man. It's really, we're blessed with a lot of great musicians. There's a big handful of musicians that are making they're living almost exclusively in the studio down here, but it's just a big handful. It's not, man, in the late 60s and early 70s, if you had a trumpet that was made into a lamp and you took the lamp parts off, you had a gig. It was incredible, you know, back in the old days and all that stuff.
I missed out, man. I should have been down there.
We all should have been down there, man. We all should have.
You've done a lot of really inspiring work, particularly for us trumpet geeks. The recordings you do with the loud horns, that is one that still to this day, you know, just talking about Steve Patrick, that you put on and you just go, man, that is just blistering. You know, Steve did a great job on that in the role of Maynard, but you know, somebody had to hold down that lead book, which is not an easy blow.
Steve got to play 8 bars at a time. Of course, it was high Q flat all the time, and I'm back there blowing my brains out, my eyes about to pop out of my head. And the only time I really got to stand really on his level in that band was the recording of Birdland. I think it was Birdland. No, it's not Birdland. It's maybe it is, but yeah, it's Birdland. Yeah. And at the end of the tune, he and I trade fours, and I would always play it for somebody, and I would say, well, you know, who do you think is who? And anybody that knew the two of us could immediately pick out the difference in the sound and the style of it. But man, I'll tell you, that band, Joe Murphy, came up with that idea. He and Steve came up with this. Steve played with Maynard for a while, very early in Steve's career, and very late in Maynard's career. And for that couple weeks, I think he might have gone over to Japan. I don't know what the story is, but for that couple weeks, whatever it was, he assimilated the spirit of Maynard because he did a great job on that record. And that band, there's some live YouTube stuff of us playing at a jazz festival. I think it was up in Indiana. And if you can find those, man, it's the band playing live, and it sounds like the record. It really, really does. It was so much of a pleasure to play with that band. And that's a great record, and that thing will stand up for a really, really long time. I'm proud of all the work that all of us did on that recording.
Yeah, that's a great one. And if you're checking out this podcast and you have not listened to that, you need to find it. You know, I'm I'm sure you can find it on streaming services or just buy the CD somewhere. If they still, do they still make CDs? I don't even know, man.
Yeah, I think they do. And most people use them as coasters after they load, if they can load them into their computer. It's funny, man, you mentioned that because I replaced, can you still see me? I got a blank screen.
Okay. I can see.
I did some work on this computer that we're on right now, and I took the optic drive out and did this and put a solid state drive back in, man. That was a lot of work. Little teeny tiny screws, the smallest screws I've ever seen.
Yeah. I'm usually the big screw up, so I don't work with the little screws. but speaking of big, you at one time were a hefty boy.
I was. Let's see. It would be June of 1999. I had just gotten off the road with a girl named Winona Judd, a member of the Judds, and you know, flaming red hair. It was a great gig. It was Big Jim Horn and Rock Williams. So it was a three piece, two saxes and trumpet. We had a big time out there, and it was one of the best gigs in my life. It was really incredible. Big Jim and I were working together a ton at the time, and Winona was pregnant. So we were on salary for the year based on the number of dates we were doing. And we went all the way through. And then for the whole summer, she had a baby. And Jim and I worked, and good Lord, man, we made so many records and so much money that year. So at the end of that, June of 1999, I went to the doctor, and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, Vin, you're fat and you're going to die." I was like, "Dude, seriously." He's like, "I'm not kidding. You need to lose 60 pounds quick, and then you need to lose another 40, and you need to keep it off. If you want to see your son graduate from high school, VJ, my son, who's 29 now, he was 8 at the time. And he said, if you want to see him graduate from high school, man, you got to get your stuff together. And that was all it took for me. So I went back out on tour with Lyle Lovett that summer, and in 10 weeks, I lost 35 pounds. And then for about a year, I was 313 when I started, 313 pounds when I started. For about a year, I did yoga. And then I started training for a sprint triathlon. And then for about eight years, I lifted really heavy and did a bunch of cardio in the gym. And I got down to about, I don't know, maybe 230, 235. And then I started bicycling about 10 years ago. And that has helped me drop that additional 20 pounds. And so now I'm sitting at about 215 and have lost near 100 pounds and kept it off for a really long time. Yeah, it's super important, man. I drink a lot of water. I track all of my food. Every day I've tracked for almost 2,000 days in a row, and I get regular exercise, and I just try and be smart about it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations, man.
Thank you very much.
But one of the reasons I wanted to bring that up, I mean, not just the fact that I think that for anyone, you know, your health, obviously, it's all you got, man. You know, all the other stuff, you know, that's just secondary. You got to be healthy if you're going to enjoy your life, and, you know. But I also know that when you have any level of drastic change in your body, particularly as it relates to weight gain or weight loss, that, you know, it affects your body structure, it affects your musculature and things like that. How did your weight change affect your playing? And if it did, what steps did you take to, you know, find your center again?
I did that is different from a lot of people. So it took me years to get to 313 pounds, like a lot of years. When I was in high school, I weighed 190 or 195 pounds. I wore a size 36 pants. Through college and through the different gigs and drinking beer and eating a lot of pizza, you know, I ballooned up, and I was late 30s, really. So it took 20 years to gain 100 pounds, more than 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. I think the problem that a lot of us run into is that you it's so discouraging to start a diet and not lose 100 pounds in a week.
Right.
And anybody that's using their brain realizes that it took a long time to get, and it's going to take a long time to lose. So I was, and this is not a virtue that I share in any other part of my life, except for maybe trumpet. I was very, very patient. And I did it right. So I did it through, for me, this is what works for me. I did it through diet, proper diet, and exercise. Now, I tried every fad diet. I was low, extremely low carb for 3 or 4 years. I mean, net 20 carbs for 4 years. And I was doing 75 mile bike rides on like 60 grams of carbohydrates a day. I lived on caffeine a lot. So I made some mistakes, but basically for me, everything is on the table. If I want to have a glass of wine, or if I want to drink a beer, which I don't drink a lot of because of some other issues, but if I want to have a shot of tequila, I kind of build that into my day. My wife and I go 3 times a week and have frozen yogurt. We get the no sugar and the no fat added, you know what I mean? And right. And we just work it into the system. And when you can go for a bike ride and burn 600 to 800 calories an hour, you don't have to be on the bike that long to be able to afford yourself with a little bit of wiggle room in your diet, you know. Right. I have friends that have lost 100 pounds or 100 pounds or more in a year, and it's really, really affected their chops, because in addition to losing fat, because they went from 5,000 calories a day to 1,200 calories a day, their body started to cannibalize their muscle mass. Right. So they didn't have this anymore. They didn't have that anymore. And they didn't have these anymore. So if you lose 10% of this, it's not that big a deal. You have 200 muscles in your face. If you lose 10% of all those little micro muscles, it really makes a huge difference. Plus, you don't have the fat around your chops anymore that kind of pads things. This is the way you've been playing for 20 years. I know guys that have lost an octave off their range because they've lost so much muscle mass in losing the weight super quickly.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to tell somebody who is morbidly obese, 313 pounds, hey man, just try and lose a pound a week. And I'm like, screw that, man. That's going to take 2 years to lose 100 pounds. Well, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, when you're 40 years old, 2 years is a blink of an eye. And if you can be disciplined to lose one. Now, if you weigh 300 pounds, when you cut out a lot of your carbs and a lot of your junk, and you stop drinking beer and you stop eating, you know, macaroni and cheese or pizzas, you know, giant pizzas, you're going to lose weight pretty quickly in that first couple of months.
Right.
So you might lose 20 or 30 pounds in the first couple of months, but you're going to plateau. If I told a fat person, and I can say that as a formerly fat person, if I told a fat person, you need to lose 100 pounds, if you lose 1 pound a week, how long will it take you? It's basically 2 years. It's like a light bulb goes off over their head. It's really incredible. Slow and steady, like the tortoise and the hare, wins the race. And because I did it slowly, my trumpet playing has gotten better because my infrastructure has gotten stronger. I carry about 190 pounds of what they call lean body mass. So that's muscle and bones and organs and all that kind of stuff. And at 215, I'm really at well under 20%, really close to 15% body fat, which if you're not an Olympic athlete, that's, you know, the average American male is well into the 20s, you know, right. 21-22%. So man, it's a lot of information. And I would say, as a result of this particular podcast, if anybody wants to reach out, I am not a pro, but I sure can tell you what worked for me. And I can talk you down off the ledge a lot of times with regard to binging and water intake and all that kind of stuff. I think the two key things are you have to find a cardio exercise that you love and that you can do until the day that you die when you're 100 years old. That's the first thing. The second thing is you have to drink copious amounts of water. On an average day, I'm somewhere between 150 and 220 ounces of water. I drink water constantly. This is 40 ounces, so I'll drink 5 of these a day.
But water is such a crucial component to our, not just the nutrition, but just our lives. You know, the fact that our body's comprised of so much water, and it's the one thing that we just try to avoid like the plague.
I know. People don't like the taste of it. And believe me, if you're running into chop problems and you're having a problem in the morning, drink yourself a big old 20 ounces of water. An hour later, you're going to be hydrated. Your chops are going to be nice and supple the way they need to be. And you're going to be playing better. It helps with trumpet playing too. I'm a firm believer in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that information.
Yes, sir.
Look, that's part of what I'm trying to do with this podcast is, to introduce people to people who have information, have stories to tell, who have experiences to share, because, that's the way we learn. We learn through experience, but it doesn't have to be your experience. If there's something that you've gone through that you can share with somebody that prevents them from having to deal with some of the basically the shit that you've had to deal with in your life, or I've had to deal with in my life, I think that is what we're here on earth for. We're here to help other people to be better through our achievements and through our mistakes. So
hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I agree 100%. And let me just add to that, if I may. I didn't used to talk about this a lot, but I found that with the different situations that people are faced with, some people, it's addiction to alcohol or trendy chemicals. Some people it's their weight. Some people it's their personality, which they're not going to do much about, which I've suffered from in the past too. I haven't always been the go be awesome guy. Sometime in my early life, mostly as I look back on it, because I was morbidly obese. And every time I walked past the mirror, I would be disgusted with myself. And I was so full of self-hate and shame that I put on myself. I couldn't function around other people. I wasn't a good partner. I wasn't a good friend. I just wasn't a good human being. And I feel like I'm on a journey toward being much better. But there's something about me. And if anybody wants to just buzz by the old Instagram account, Trumpet Vinny, VINNIE, all one word, and just look at what we call the blue screens. So if you listen to these blue screens, basically what they are is a little 15-second snippet of whatever we've done in the studio that day. And there's hundreds of them, maybe thousands now. And it gives you an idea of what we're doing in the studio and what I sound like as a trumpet player. So when I was 25 years old, one day on a gig with this R&B band that I was with, I sneezed, and I used to hold my sneezes in, I would do that thing. And right on the back of my head right here, I got this, it felt like a shock. Like if you could imagine a big oak tree, and if you took a battery and just shocked the bottom of the tree, and it went up the tree and went out all of the branches, it was about the size of a quarter. And it was really strange, man. And I was like, golly, what was that? I sat down and, people thought I was having a stroke and all kind of different stuff. I woke up the next day and it was dead numb. Absolutely couldn't feel a thing there. And I was like, golly. So I started going to the doctor. About 3 days later, it happened again. Only this time when I sneezed, I let the sneeze go. And that nerve came over the top of my head and went down the side of my face. And when I woke up the next day, I couldn't feel anything on the left side of my entire head. Straight down the middle, everything on the left is completely numb. Like when, what it feels like when your foot or your leg falls asleep?
Yeah.
Not the pins and needles, but that dead, you can't even stand up feeling, that's what it feels like. So then it happened again. And it went all the way down my body, all the way down to my toes. I found out through going to the doctor that it's called a syrinx or syringomyelia. It's this long cyst that looks a little bit like a pencil. It's about that long. They're different lengths for different people. Inside of my spinal cord, it's a congenital condition. And so I had an operation when I was 25 years old. They cut up on the back of my neck, took a vertebrae off, and they drained it, and they put a little teeny tiny shunt in it, and it drains and dissipates down my spinal cord. To this day, sitting here in front of you right now, I cannot feel anything on the left side of my body. My hands, my face, my leg. When I got out of the hospital, I couldn't walk because I couldn't tell where I was putting the pressure on my heel. And I couldn't coordinate it. So it took me a little while to learn how to walk. So for me to be able to play trumpet, not feeling half of my face, half of my diaphragm, not being able to feel how I manipulate the first and third valve slides. At this level that I've been able to achieve through really, really diligent and tenacious practicing is nothing short of a miracle, in my opinion. The fact that I can ride a bike, now, you know, I'm not going to win the Tour de France. Matter of fact, I'm going to be the guy that's the very last cat going up those hills, but I enjoy it so much, and it's saved my life. It's right. Saved my health, being able to jump on that bike, burn a couple calories. So if I want to have a glass of wine at night, or if I want to have a Twinkie, if I want, you know, I can have a Twinkie. I tell you this, not so you'll feel sorry for me, because that would be ridiculous looking at, you know, my life. I just keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. Everything is awesome. I mean, it's incredible. I got incredible kids. I got an incredible family. I met a woman that I love more than anything on earth. I've got an incredible and prolific career. I am blessed beyond any measure that you could put to it. But to be able to play and do the things that I can do is just miraculous. It really is. I'm very, very thankful. I work really, really hard, and I want to encourage anybody that's running into issues, whether it is morbidly obese or with addiction or some sort of physical malady. You never know what people are walking around with, man. Yeah. Everybody's got something, right? Absolutely. Everybody's got something. Some people, it's really obvious because it's their personality, and you're like, God, what a jerk. But other people have these incredible underlying things that bubble to the surface and kind of come out their, you know, their mouth or their spirit or whatever the deal is. And so until you've walked a mile or hobbled along a mile in somebody else's shoe, in my case, or until you've tried to play a double C when you can't feel the left side of your chops, man, just give that person the benefit of the doubt. Let them prove you wrong. Always expect the best from everybody. And then just let them make their own bed. You know what I mean? And that's what this whole thing has taught me. So, and I'll be done with this in a second, man. I know it's a long story, but for 25 years, I've been wondering, because you remember Christopher Reeves, Superman?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, he snapped his neck, and then he was kind of the poster child for spinal cord injury. And mm-hmm. then, and, you know, Nick Bonacani, who was a Miami Dolphin, his son, was a paraplegic, and they started the Nick Bonacani project, and they've been making so much progress with reattaching basically your brain to your body. I always thought in the back of my mind for the last 20, 25 plus years, maybe there's a way they can fix this. You know, what if there's a way they can fix this? I was always super scared to go to the doctor because I didn't want to hear the answer one way or the other. And so I finally went last year in December. I got a complete physical. I told my doctor about it. He said, man, let's just get you to a neurologist and let's see what's going on. So we set it up. I had an MRI, took a picture of it, and I went in, and the guy, you know, it's like, he's like a mini version of me. He's a bald guy. He's a little shorter than I am. He's like, hey, how you doing? You know, that kind of guy. And I sat down with him, and before I could tell him my story, he looks at me and he tells me what it is. It's a syrinx, and it's a syringeal, whatever it's called. I did a bunch of research on it, and And I said, well, listen, man, I told him the story I just told you, you know, Christopher Reeves and reattaching nerves and all that kind of stuff. And before I could get the end of the sentence, he looked at me and he said, oh, you're never going to get any of that back. Never. And I was just, I started crying. I mean, I was crestfallen. And I said, dude, do you realize what 25 years of living with this is like and the hope that I had? And you just seriously just chop me off at the neck. You might as well just, you know, cut off my head. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but I got to be straightforward and honest with you and let you know what you're dealing with. And at that moment, I thought, you know what? He's right. I said, is it ever going to get any worse? And he said, it will never get worse. You'll never get any back and it will never get any worse. And that was like, that was another miraculous moment in my life when I found out exactly what I'm going to be dealing with for the rest of the time that I'm on this planet. And so it turned from this super defeating, like soul crushing answer to one of the best moments of my life, because now I got a baseline.
Yeah.
I know what to expect for the rest of my life. And so if you're dealing with, and Jose and I just had a conversation about a kid that's dealing with focal dystonia. If you can get past it, man, or you can figure out a way to deal with it, man, just celebrate that and live in that moment and be positive about it and pass it on to other people and give them hope too, because I will tell you, man, I'm on several Facebook groups that with other people that have this, and they, because they have no hope, they're just miserable. They're just miserable. They're fat and they're alcoholics and they're this and that and the other thing, because they can't, nobody understands what they're going through. But I'm telling them, look, here's the deal. It sucks. It sucks when you, you know, you bang your hand on the desk and you can't feel it. You know what I mean? It's just weird. It's so strange, but at least you know what you got. And you can move forward in that direction. Anyway, that's my little soapbox for today.
Oh man, that's some great stuff. And you know, I didn't realize that about you. And thanks for sharing that story, because I think that, you know, if there's nothing else that comes out of my entire career on this podcast, I think this is going to be one of those defining things.
Oh, good, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, because it goes beyond just that condition. Right.
Yeah.
That's the symptom. Yeah. You know, the underlying problem for all of us in one way or another is just the limiting beliefs that we placed on ourselves. And it'd be very easy for you to just, you know, put your horn in the case and that was it. But, you know, not only have you continued to play, but you have continued to play at a high level, at a world-class level. So, you know, if you're out there and you're dealing with some sort of issue, yeah, there is a solution. And the solution is just don't give up. Just keep.
That is the truth. And here's the other thing, man. During the pandemic, I've seen a lot of guys. Here's what's going to happen. The guy that is most prepared at the end of this, the guy that has practiced and been diligent, even though there's no end in sight, that's the guy that's going to, it's not a win or lose situation, but that's the guy that's going to come out on top. Because when he gets the call, he's ready. He doesn't have to go, golly, I got to get my face back together. I've seen so many guys say, I'm starting to get my face back together. I'm starting to get my chops. I've been off the horn for 10 weeks and now I'm going to start practicing again. And here's what I got to say to you, every single one of you. If you can feel your whole face and you don't have any physical problems that are keeping you from the trumpet, I'm not a big shame guy at all. I think it's a wasted emotion, but I want you to put yourself in my shoes. Because if you're not taking advantage of this time and making yourself better, shame on you. I want you to make yourself better. I want you to go into that closet, wherever that horn is stored, whatever barriers that you have to break through, and get back on that horn and practice every day. Because if you're sitting at home and you don't have nothing else to do, why are you wasting that time? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
absolutely. Instead of sitting around worrying about where you're going to get, you know, how you're going to pay your mortgage or whatever the deal is, which are real situations. I'm with you 100%. But instead of sitting around worrying, take it and put it into that trumpet, because that energy that you put in, you're going to get back. You're going to get back in spades. And I am a testament. I am a living testament sitting right in front of this camera right now to tell you that what you put in, I was given a thimble full of talent. Thimble. full of talent compared to a lot of cats that I know. But I have worked that talent to death and made a career. And you can do it too, man. Just got to get up off your butt, start practicing, and go be awesome.
See, now you got me all inspired, man. So,
yes, sir.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. It's like, where did the Go Be Awesome come from? Where did you come up with that catchphrase?
This is a fantastic story. Joe Murphy, the guy that did the Loud Horns, he also did another band called, and if you can find this record, it's called Conversation. He and Jim Williamson. Jim has since passed from cancer just this last year. The most beautiful, I told you this before, Jose, the most beautiful flugelhorn sound I've ever heard in my life came out of Jim Williamson. And it didn't matter what horn he was on. There was just something about his chops, and his body and the way that he approached it. It was the warmest, most buttery, beautiful sound I ever heard in my life. So Joe Murphy was the brainchild behind Conversation and the Loud Horns. He's the assistant marching band director at Vanderbilt University. He writes a bunch of marching band shows every year, custom shows. At one point he was doing like 40, crazy amount. Like he sits from like the beginning of April through the end of August, he just sits in front of a computer and writes the music. It's really amazing. So Joe and I used to be involved with a group here in Nashville called the Music City Legend, and they were a Drum Corps Associates, DCA, all-age drum and bugle corps. I was pulled in to rehearse the line during the first year. They were just getting ready to go up to Rochester to go to finals. And I came in and I was just cleaning some stuff, and so I stood in front of them. And then the next year they hired me as the caption head. And then I eventually became the corps director. So Joe was the arranger and took care of the music while I was directing. And one day, you didn't get to play the show, perform the show every night like you do with DCI. Mm-hmm. DCA, you got to do maybe a half a dozen live runs a year. You know, the DCI corps are doing that in a week. And so the it's pay to play and it's all age and anything from 15 up to like 65, I think was our oldest member. And the corps was really making a mark and kicking some butt. And we were at our first show in, I think, 2005 or 2006. And Joe and I would always, we were sideline lizards. So I'd play high notes and he would play the tuba and we would knock everybody out with, Joe is just he's an acrobat on the tuba. And so we're standing there and as the corps is marching out onto the field to get into their opening position, I'm standing there and I said to one of the guys that was particularly nervous, I said, "Dude, if you trip over the cure for cancer on the 50-yard line, we're going to split it amongst everybody in the corps. Cool?" And in that moment, he kind of realized, we're blowing into tubes for fun. We're not curing cancer, right? And then Joe followed it up with a swat on the tail to one of his friends that was in the corps. And he said, "Go be awesome." And at that moment, it changed my life. It was one of those moments I'll never forget. I can smell the grass. I know exactly where I was. I can see the person that was standing in front of me. His name is Barry. And he was a little baritone player. And when Joe said that, I thought, golly, man. Because basically what it means to me is, first of all, you're not telling anybody what to do. So don't get me wrong when I say go be awesome. I'm not telling you what to do. Basically what I'm asking you to do is go and absolutely always give your best effort. And that's what it is in a nutshell, basically. Always do your best, whether it's in a personal relationship, whether it's whether it's playing your horn, whether it's playing kickball with the kids, whatever the deal is, cleaning the house, always do your best. And sometimes your best is going to be incredible. And sometimes it's going to kind of suck, but it gives you a place to start. You know what I mean? And if you're always thinking, walking into the situation, my mother says, do the next right thing. It's kind of the same thing, but man, it's really caught on. And a lot of people really grab onto it. When I get birthday messages on Facebook, almost every single one of them says, you're awesome, continue and go be awesome. It's just, it's just amazing, really. And it's just kind of a, my very first trumpet teacher, man, same thing, Al Carroll, South Florida, 1972. And I came in one day and I was kind of dragging. He said, what's wrong, kid? And I said, I'm just having a bad day. He said, hold on. First of all, you got a trumpet in your hand. And I, you know, I said, yeah. And he said, especially when you have a trumpet in your hand, you never have a bad day. You only have good days and great days. And it seems trivial, almost silly, but it's a mindset. And if once that clicks, just like go be awesome or do the next right thing, once that clicks, in order to be a positive person, you do not have to have a smile on your face 100% of the time. You don't have to be positive 100% of the time, because then you're getting into like, it becomes forced and it's faked. If somebody in your family dies, that sucks. It's hard to be positive about that. All you really need to do is 51% of the time. You know what I mean? Now, you want that percentage to go up, but if you can get it to 51%, man, you're leading, you can tell anybody you're leading a positive life. They will be able to tell. They'll be able to look at you and say, something different about that guy. You know, no matter how bad things suck, he always finds something that's kind of cool. And so get to that 51%, and that's really what Go Be Awesome means to me. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Oh man. And speaking of awesome, you had an awesome modification done to your horn by our mutual friend, Mr. Mike Del Quadro.
I just saw a post from him this morning about some apocalyptic dream. I would be remiss if I didn't say, as a result of my relationship with Pearl and Adams, front-facing marching, Adams marching, the guys, Meal and the guys over at Adams, invited me to be an Adams custom brass artist. And this is the A4LT, medium large. And this horn, I picked it up because it's so much different than what I normally play. And when we're in the studio, basically when you're stacking yourself, if you use the exact same gear playing all the same parts, it sounds like Vinny playing four trumpet parts. If you change up the mouthpiece and you change up the horn, it gives you a little bit more of a chance to sound like Vinny and Jose playing in a section. And so for years, I've been working on Frankenhorn. So there's a guy around here over in East Tennessee named Cliff Blackburn. Cliff made beautiful and amazing instruments for years and years and years. And now they've been taken over. They took all the mandrels and they're continuing the line up at Pickett. And those guys are great up there, and they're keeping the tradition alive. The bells, lead pipes, and tuning slides that Cliff and Tina down there at Blackburn made are just beyond compare, in my opinion. So basically what I did was, years ago I collected, I have a 213 Ambronze bell and a 313, and I've been putting them on Bach bodies. So this is a Bach valve cluster, Blackburn number 20 lead pipe, large bore tuning slide, and this one is the 313 bell. This is the big dog right here. This is my number one horn. I can use it for absolutely anything. Also, Jason Harrelson added the heavy caps. Yes, they're heavy caps, and they work for me.
Well, it's because you got those big guns, man. You can hold up the heavy caps.
So what I did was, I've been chasing that number one horn for a number of years. And I've been trying to recreate it. And I don't know what it is. It's probably a little blob of solder that's on the inside that just makes it feel absolutely perfect for me. But this is my number two. And it's the same. It's an early Elkhart valve cluster, number 20, large bore. This is a 213 bell. But what I had done was, I wanted to sort of experiment around with a bunch of different things with regard to the bell. So I contacted Mike, who I love. Here's the thing about Mike. If he likes you, you know it. And if he doesn't, you know that too.
Know it. Yeah.
And I love being on that kind of a level playing field with anybody that I'm working with, because, you know, if I do something to piss you off and you don't tell me, I can't do anything to fix it. And I don't think we're ever going to have that problem with Mike. He's been a joy to work with. I contacted him about 6 months ago. We put it on the schedule. So this is what I want to do. I want to make this not a tuning bell. I want to make it modular. So Mike, can you see this part up here that I'm pointing to?
Yep. Got it.
And down here, the brace. Mike, through a little bit of trial and error, created this set screw. And you loose these. Come down here and do it here. And the workmanship on this is just incredible. This is all custom work. And he just, he was highly communicative. He sent me pictures. He sent me videos. It was like a kid at Christmas. So this is what the only two contact points are the braces. And what he did was, let me put this down very carefully. What he did was he put a piece of Teflon on this brace. So the bell just kind of cradles in there. It's not bound down by a screw or one of those L channels like you'll see. Let me put this somewhere where it's not going to get screwed up. And so basically what he did was he put a bell tail on it that fits into the receiver. And now I have the 213 and I also have a sterling silver Eclipse bell that I'm trying out on the horn too. Now, here's the really cool thing. The Blackburn plays exactly like it did before. There is no appreciable difference, which I really appreciate because I love the way that bell plays. The Eclipse plays really, really well. I love the sound. Super zippy, man. I mean, it's like a flamethrower. But it plays a little bit sharp. So I couldn't figure it out. At first I thought it was me, you know, which is really likely. but what we did was we came up with, because the bells are different, the bell tail is a different bore size on the Eclipse, we need to add a little bit of bell tail. And Mike and I had a really cool conversation about it. He was super chill, as was I. And very high level of communication. And he said, all right, well, let's set it up for when you need it. I said, man, I love the Blackburn. I'm going to play it for a while. I'm going to play both bells. I want to make sure it's me. I will take pictures of where the tuning slide is. And basically what he's going to do on the Eclipse, he's going to add some length to the bell tail. And that will bring the pitch down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a remarkable experience. First of all, his work is incredible. So if he was a jackass, you would still go to him because his work is so good. But I can't wait until this pandemic is under control, because Beth and I are going to go out to Vegas, and she's going to gamble away the family fortune, although she's not much of a gambler, except she did marry me. And I'm going to hang with Mike for a couple of days, pet his dogs, and just sit there and listen to his stories. He's a great dude. If you need any custom work done, I haven't played the Grizzly or any of the horns yet, but I am afraid to go because I know I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to love it. And then he's going to have another $3,000 of my money.
Yeah. Well, when you see Del Quadro, one, ask him for some brisket, and two, ask him about Minnie and Mickey Mouse in Anaheim.
I will.
There's a great story that involves a few people, you'll want to hear that one. So.
I've seen him say, you know, it's interesting because he's like, if somebody comes into the shop, and they want to hang out while I'm working. You know, I think he's a guy that's pretty intense and pretty focused on what he's doing. He says, but if you'll come in and tell me stories, you can stay as long as you want. And you know, you got to love that, man, because, yeah. I mean, I got a ton of stories, so I'm likely to be there camped out for a week. But yeah, I'm excited about meeting him, and I would encourage anybody, any trumpet player, man. I mean, there's a lot of really great techs. My local guy here, Chris Roush, is the Pearl guy. He works on all the flutes that come in from Japan. He tweaks them and techs them before he sends them out to the store. But his brass work is remarkable. I just really thought that Mike lined up as far as a creative mind with me on this particular conversion. The cool thing about this is the more bells I find, all I got to do is send the horn back to him and he just modifies the bell. And so I could have a horn with infinite number of bells on it, and it each one changes the characteristics sound wise so right. much that, you know, you could create a 10-piece trumpet ensemble with just those bells. And that, yeah. I'm really excited about that. I think that'd be cool.
Well, I love that concept because, you know, like you were saying, when you're doing a lot of stacking, and you're able to get that uniqueness of the sound. Yep. Like, you know, my horn, the trumpet I play has a titanium bell, so it has a very unique sound. You know,
is it a Schilke?
No, actually, it's a Warburton.
Oh, nice.
So and yeah, it'll peel your face.
Oh, you gotta like that.
Yeah. But you know, it's you know, if I'm laying down like a, you know, a third trumpet part or something like that, then that's not what it's built for.
That A4LT, man, and it's the medium large. I tried the large bore, the Adams large bore, and it just, when I was 25, I played a large bore Colicchio 470, gigantic horn, great sounding instrument. I just don't want to work that hard anymore. Well, it's not that I don't want to work that hard. It's that I can't work that hard anymore. At 57, you know, I just kind of want to hang. And if I got to play a double C, I don't want to work my tailbone off. I just want to be able to play it, man, and get out. Gary Grant told me a story one time. I had the pleasure of going to lunch with him, and he said he has a mouthpiece that he calls the double scale mouthpiece. And I'm like, I don't understand. He said, well, if I take it out of the box, it's automatically double scale. And of course, Gary, if you know him or know of him, you know, there's just not an assuming bone in his body. So
exactly.
It's funny because I think he means it, but you can't really tell if he's pulling your leg. So I, of course, after that, I play Steve Patrick's stuff. As a matter of fact, I have one right here that I was trying out. Patrick Mouthpieces. Steve is doing a really good job of creating mouthpieces that make it easier to play the trumpet. And I switch around a ton. I know a lot of people don't do that. But I mean, in any given session, I'll play two different flugelhorn mouthpieces on two different flugelhorns, and I'll have three or four B-flats. All of them have a different setup. Some of them, it's a dime with a hole punched in it. And some of them, it's, you know, a 1.5 C. And based on where I am in the section, that's the one that I use. But he's got a mouthpiece. Steve's got a mouthpiece. I think it's the 94S. And honest to goodness, man, it might as well be a blank. It's just like, you have to be in such incredible shape to play this mouthpiece. I mean, because there's so much compression and so much room for error for me. Like, if I'm not right on the money, I'll play 15 notes and then eventually get there like, whatever it is. So I started calling it my double scale mouthpiece, because if I need to play a real easy, if I've been playing for 2 or 3 hours and I need to play a double C, I take that thing out of the box, man, pop it in. And second time, it's just pick off right out of the blue. And it's a great piece. And I've jokingly said, as I take it out of the box, this is my Gary Grant double scale mouthpiece. And people go, what does that mean? And I tell them the story that I just told you. And I say, so what do you think? And without fail, they all go, no, that's not going to happen. Well, if somebody ever does it, man, I'm going to document it. I'm going to like take a video recording of it. And I'm going to send it to Gary, and I'm going to put it all over social media, but it really does make Steve's stuff in combination with the different horns that I have really, really make my life a lot easier, and I'm super appreciative of him. You know, it's interesting because he's always had an emphasis on the mouthpiece thing. This pandemic has hit a lot of guys really hard, and the big orchestra sessions, which is what Steve does a lot of here in town, they're not happening. You can't put 80 people in a room because the flute players can't wear masks, and they're blowing 15 feet of potential lethal germs across the room. And so it's really slowed things down. So he's putting some extra effort into the mouthpieces. So anybody that's on the Safari, go to the website, patrickmouthpiece.com, and just check him out, because they're super reasonable. He's got a guy working for him named Chris Rhymes. Chris is from Boston originally. He used to work with Trent Austin when Trent had his shop in Boston. Mm-hmm. And he just became a new dad. Got a little girl, and a great trumpet player. Came down here to go to Belmont University, got his master's. And he's a good dude. Steve is kind of the creative goofball. And Chris is the guy, kind of the glue that holds the company together. So he takes care of all of the social media, all the marketing, all of the shipping, all the mouthpieces are at his house, basically. And it's really brought that company together to be a force in the mouthpiece world. So I just encourage anybody to go over there and buy a mouthpiece. Steve needs the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
I wish I'll sell my mouthpieces too. So. All right. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do our little rapid fire round here to wind things up for the day.
Awesome.
We'll see how you do with this. Questions all over the place. Your shortest answer. I feel like Richard Dawson, a famous. Survey says, okay, here's the first one. Who's the biggest influence on your life that's not a trumpet player?
I would have to say Hank Levy, my college jazz ensemble professor.
Mm. Great guy. Great writer, man.
Towson University, and played with played with Don Ellis and the Old Man, and just an incredibly prolific writer. He was real into exotic time meters. I didn't play in four in college until I was a junior in jazz ensemble. How about that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of like backwards, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, what's your favorite book?
Mike Rowe has a new book right now, and it's, I'm not sure the title of it. It's a New York bestseller, but it's a bunch of his podcasts and stories. I love listening to him and reading his stuff, Mike Rowe's book, yeah.
All right. What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
You know, my wife and I have been watching a bunch of stuff on the Hallmark Channel.
Oh.
You know, so really, aside from The Good Witch, I would say almost any movie I've seen on the Hallmark Channel. I love Hallmark. I love your cards and I love your channel. I'm just not. Yeah.
Just the movies. Yeah, yeah, I got you. If you weren't a trumpet player, what would you want to do?
I would be a chef. When I was 9 years old and I started playing the trumpet, that's what I want to be for a couple of years there. And I love to cook. I'm not very good at it. My wife seems to enjoy it, but I think it's mostly because she doesn't have to do it.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. You could be granted any one superpower. What would you choose?
The ability to transport myself anywhere at any time, instantly. Like if I wanted to be at your place and we could do this as a live interview, I could just snap my fingers or press a button on my really cool watch and just poof, I'd be there. Yeah. And I could do more sessions that way too.
Exactly.
I could schedule at 10 o'clock and play all the way up until like 1:55 and still make a 2 o'clock session.
And
so I would have to be able to take my trumpets with me too. So it's just not transporting me. It's anything that I'm holding. Yeah.
And make sure you have that Gary Grant double scale mouthpiece.
I never leave home without it, man, just in case.
Just think, you know, if you could do 10 sessions a day and get double scale on all of them.
Ooh, lordy, I'd work one day a week.
All right. What aspect of trumpet playing do you think is the most overrated?
Overrated. High notes. High trumpet playing. I think a lot of times in certain circumstances, it doesn't serve the music very well. You know, once you put a high note on that, and sometimes I'll just say, yeah, I will, but I just don't think it's necessary, you know? Yeah.
What aspect of trumpet playing do you think is the most underrated?
Multiple tonguing. I think that's, especially on the commercial side of things. Obviously in the classical world, they're very, very focused on it, but being able to double tongue, honestly, being able to double tongue a high G proficiently, I think that is a skill that is highly underrated. Most people are just struggling to squeak those notes out. But, you know, like there's the story of, I mean, it's either Faddis or it's Wayne Bergeron or it's somebody. And somebody says, man, I'm having trouble with this horn. You know, the high F on or high G on this horn doesn't speak. I'm like, well, let me see it. And they take it and they put their mouthpiece in and they go, and they go, feels okay to me. Hand it back to the guy.
That sounds like a Faddis thing.
That could be a Faddis thing, but it could really could be any of those guys, you know.
Yeah, but John is definitely a character when it comes to stuff like that. What's your favorite drink?
Water.
All right. This is my favorite question to ask everyone. You could have a dinner party and invite any three living people. Who would they be?
I think it would be Barack Obama. And if we could count him as one, his wife.
Hey, plus one.
Yeah, plus one. I would really love to sit down with Jerry Hay and really be, you know, instead of fanboying him, just kind of, you know, hey, Jerry, I've listened to all your stuff. Just listen to a couple things that I've done so that you know that I can play, and then we can talk on a different level. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My father, my dad.
Okay, cool. Same thing, you're having a dinner party. You're going to invite any three people from history.
Clifford Brown, Maynard Ferguson, and Abraham Lincoln.
Wow, if you get all six people together, that would be one Shoo! Hell of a dinner party.
Lord have mercy, that'd be cool.
Oh, yeah. Okay, what's your favorite quote?
It has to be Go Be Awesome, because it's a quote from my friend Joe. So I don't think you can go wrong there.
Yeah, that's a good one to have. What's your greatest fear?
My greatest fear. Well, I say this jokingly sometimes, but this is a reality. I have a fear that a lot of times when I go into the studio, that they're finally going to figure out that I'm a fraud. Like, you know, you're going to play and maybe the note's not going to come out at the end of the horn or something like that. I'm so prepared when I leave the house. I mean, I get up at 6 o'clock for a 10 o'clock session and I play for 90 minutes, sometimes 2 hours before I leave the house, so that my first note out of the end of the horn is as close to what it's supposed to be as possible. So I don't think that's going to happen. But then, you know, the crazy part of your brain kind of, you know, it's crazy.
That's true. All right, you're going to be able to go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice about music. What would that advice be?
Basically, it's about music and it's about life. And it's something that I struggled with as a young man. And it's a little blue, so you might have to bleep it out. Don't be a dick. That's it. If I could only say one thing to my 20-year-old or 17-year-old self, that's what it would be, because I struggled with that for, and still do really, I fail on a daily basis, but I struggled with that for a good 20 years coming out of high school, just a lack of direction and self-worth and that whole nine yards. So yeah, don't be a dick.
Okay. Well, this show is not rated, so you can say whatever you want.
All right.
And the final question I want to ask you is, what do you want your legacy to be?
My recordings, my discography. I want my son and my grandkids and their kids after them to be able to shoot a Google on my name and go over to AllMusic and pick out a song and listen to their dad or their grandfather or their great grandfather play. It's always been really important to me. I think every time I go in the studio, I am creating part of my legacy. And I'm hoping, just like I listen to, you know, all the way through my career, trumpet players and bands and horn sections, I'm hoping that one day somebody can be influenced in a positive way by some of the stuff that we've laid down.
Well, I can tell you this, man, I already have been influenced by your work. prolific recording, inspiring player. And I'm just really thankful for the time today because you are an inspiring human. And I think, at the end of it all, that's what it's all about, man.
I agree 100%. And thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate it.
Well, and I am looking forward to my ability to get down there to Nashville at some point and get a hot
dip in the new pool.
Yeah, dip in the new pool, have a hot chicken sandwich. There we go. All right. So thank you very much, Vinny. And for those of you who joined us on this podcast, thank you very much for listening and your support. And we've got plenty more episodes coming up. So until next time, peace and slide grease. We are out. Hey, thank you so much for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating connection through our mutual love for the trumpet life. I hope that you learned a few things about today's guest and had some laughs along the way. Don't forget to give us a review. We love those 5-star ratings. And please share this podcast with your friends. We want to see our hang grow for show. Have a suggestion for a future topic or a guest? Hit me up at thetrumpetgurus@gmail.com. Our opening theme was written and performed by Lexi Signor, and all other music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. So in the words of W.C. Handy, life is like a trumpet. If you don't put anything into it, you don't get anything out. So go out there and let your trumpet sound. And I'll see you at the next hang.